You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Justice. I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And the episode synopsis is: when Wesley Crusher is condemned to die on an idyllic, primitive planet, Captain Picard must face breaking the Prime Directive to save the boy's life. This is the 8th episode of Season 1 of Star Trek The Next Generation. The original release date was 9th of November 1987. It was written by Ralph Wills and Rorley Thorne, and it was directed by James L. Conway. Guest stars are Brenda Back as Reven and Jay Lauder as Leotor. So, what do we think about this episode? Now, personally, I always had this episode has the reputation of being horrendous, and I rewatched it, obviously, in anticipation of this review. And I found more things to like about it than I probably should admit. So I don't think it's a great episode, but it certainly wasn't as bad as I remember it. And what about you, Lou?
Well, there's nothing wrong with softcore porn. I mean, it's so soft. It's just subtle, you know, like people making out in the hallways. You're walking by a couple that's basically humping each other. I don't know. If we get past all the cheesiness of it and we think about the moral story, I like it, actually. This is going to get a pretty high rating, I think, because of the moral story. So, we find ourselves on a Class M planet in the Rubicon star system. It's inhabited, unusually lovely, but they obviously are pre-warped, so we're just going to leave them alone for now, right?
Yeah, that was something that was confusing to me. These guys, they're clearly pre-warp, right? So I don't know what we're doing down there. But it is unusually lovely, and as Geordi and then later Tasha confirm, these guys make love at a drop of a hat.
Any hat.
Any hat.
Okay. One thing I do want to mention before we actually get heavy into the show. I have not gotten any feedback on this, nor have you said anything, but a couple weeks ago we recorded Where No One Has Gone Before. And as you know, we had our guests Mark Stamper and Paul Finch. And one of the things we had talked about in that show was men in dresses. And then after we recorded that, I didn't even think about it until recently. Where's Paul Finch from?
Wait, he's from Scotland.
Scotland.
Hmm.
And Scottish men in ceremonies wear kilts.
I believe that technically referred to as dresses.
Well, I don't know. We over here, we call them kilts. So now I was thinking, you know, when I go into one of my diatribes, as I like to call them, about men in dresses, could I be offending an entire race of people? That, you know, who the kilt goes back to the 16th century. I remember when my uncle was buried, he had full military honors, which meant he had the 21-gun salute here, and he also had a Scottish playing of Amazing Grace. And I thought both of them, you know, it's funny. I was raised Catholic. I've been to many funerals, okay, at church, and they were all boring as hell. No offense, God. But, on the other hand, when Uncle Louis died, and he had the military honors, the whole taps, the Amazing Grace, that had more of an impact on me than any other funeral I'd ever been to. So, you know, if I have kind of offended anyone with the whole men in dresses thing, I think I'm going to dial that back. So I do apologize preemptively before it offends anybody. Okay? I hope we're okay with that. Cool?
I'm sure you're not offended anyone.
I'm sure not too.
I'm certain.
But still, you know, you're preemptive. It's not nice to be that mean, because I think the Scottish kilt is awesome. And then I read that even Ireland does the same thing. All right?
I don't know. I'm not entirely sure. Although there is a clear like historic and cultural connection between Ireland and Scotland. Mm-hmm.
So, although I will take a chance and say, Paul, if you've ever been in a kilt, I'd like to see the picture.
Whoa! Hang on. he not only has been in a kilt, but he was in the kilt on his wedding day.
Oh, was he? And, I want to see the picture.
There are pictures on the internet.
Oh, I
have
must.
To Google that far.
Okay, I will have to find that. So, anyway, that was fun. Now let's go back to give this just some justice. Okay, so they send Riker on a scouting mission, right? And once he's done doing the Riker maneuver, he's going to come back and give a report to the captain.
Yep.
How long do you think Riker was down there, and what was he doing?
You mean we're talking about in the first instance, right? This is
yes.
When he comes in onto the bridge. He comes in onto the bridge with extremely pleased with himself, if I could say so. He seems to have been enjoying himself. It's strange because almost everyone that goes down on the second like mission were there initially. I think it's only Troy and Wesley that weren't there.
Right.
Actually, and Worf as well. Worf as well. But they do, yeah, you know, Riker and Yar in particular, they've been down once before. I'm thinking, you know, they've probably been down for a couple of weeks. Well, you know, they've got their shore leave in early. And then, you know, they're sent down again.
So you think when Tasha reports that, or Riker reports that they'd make love at the drop of a... Oh, no, that was...
That was Geordi.
Geordi. So he must have just been reading the mission logs or something. I was wondering, you know, when Yar says any hat, is that from experience or is it something she heard?
Also, did she take several hats with her? But was that the issue?
Throw four of them up in the air. Come on, boys! Yes. Okay. But anyway, so yeah, they shouldn't have been there because they were pre-warp. And they shouldn't have interfered whatsoever, especially when God warns them, you know, don't mess with my children. Yes, sir, we're on our way. But they can't because Riker can't help himself.
Yes. I mean, I do think that clearly the state of the planet, right, like culturally and the like, they must have been completely scared. Witless with these people beaming down and reckoning that they're from a big spaceship. It's something that's completely glossed over right in the episode.
Right.
There's no reference to, you know, why is there contact between these people and the Federation? They've only just recently discovered the planet. They make that very clear. There hasn't been previous contact. And it sounds like, you know, off camera before the episode, they just sent some people down and had a good time. It's a little bit weird, especially considering that one of the major threats that hangs over Picard's decisions throughout the episode is how they are not supposed to interfere. Perhaps I'm wrong, but sending Riker and Yar down for a 2-week stag party to see the locals, isn't that interference?
Yeah, right. I mean, even. Captain Janeway had an issue like this. You know, they were pre-warp, which means we don't interfere, and to which Neelix says, that's an enlightened philosophy. So obviously there was an issue with the Prime Directive. It didn't just progress to Voyager, you know. Maybe it's because Picard went down to the Edo home world that... What was the name of that planet? Rubicon 3?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, At least that was mentioned. Is that the star system or the planet?
Well, it's a Rubicon star system. Yeah, I think it was Rubicon 3, if I'm not mistaken. I have memory alpha up. I'll check it while we go along.
Yeah, Rubicon 3.
Okay. So, now, they're ultra-lawful. They make love at the drop of a hat. Like we said, any hat. So, now, these people are almost partly pornographic, in a sense. So, why don't we bring a teenage boy down?
It's strange, right? In particular, Wesley is sent down to kind of evaluate the planet for young people's needs. Now, if the young people just want to go out and relax, I mean, maybe I'm being old-fashioned, but you just give them a stick and a bucket of sand, and that's about it. I mean, it's not as if they're going to Disneyland and he's looking at the rides and sending back a report. I don't think there's anything that Wesley could have done in this mission other than get himself into trouble, which, unfortunately, that's the way things turn out.
Mm-hmm. It's the way it turns out.
And I like how the... I don't like it. It's noteworthy that the teaser ends with Picard stating, you know, well, let's hope this planet's not too good to be true. Now, he should know better than that. He's tempting fate already. The planet's going to turn out to be too good to be true.
Sure. And there's something off the starboard bow, but there's nothing there. And as I read, I don't know what you call it, space station ship, or whatever that was off the starboard bow, gets to use again as a Lysian outpost.
Apparently that's true. Later on in season 5, I believe.
Yeah.
It's strange. I mean, I think this is one of the first, I think the only instance I can remember of them kind of not being able to see something with their senses, but knowing something's out there. What data does, you can obviously scan it in a particular way. It doesn't get flagged up as being anything in particular. But they do think that there's something out there, and yes, later we see that it is something. It's never quite established what it is, but it does have relatively large amount of power over the Enterprise and prevents them doing stuff and calling the shots towards the end of the episode.
Yeah, I got that in my notes here. Let's just hope it's not too good to be true. Yeah.
Now, was I the only person that thought that in particular at the... when they first beam down to the planet and there are all these half-naked people running around, they've got some really bad actors down there. I thought that it was pretty ropey, the interactions that go on.
Oh yeah.
In particular, the kids aren't great, and you know, just the dialogue that goes on, let's play at making love, unless you don't enjoy it. Ooh, I can see that you do. You could be arrested for less than that these days.
Yes, that's true. You're right. You could be. And you know, come on, yeah, let's play. I thought, you know, Wesley's gonna have to get in a fight with one of them before the day's over. But obviously the girl did kind of get close to Wesley, but it was just to have him teach her how to play stickball.
Yes. And I it's of particular note when Wesley gets offended at the suggestion that Starfleet can't run.
Yeah. He's
like, can't run, Commander. We can run. And then they jog in a relatively slow manner. I'm not too sure that they are running.
Right. And I have something later. You know, maybe Tasha should beam up her tricorder. Because obviously it's a hindrance to her walking or running. Do you notice how... I mean, it requires both hands to hold that tricorder in place.
Yeah, I mean, especially, to be honest, even she knows when they beam down, you know, where she's going, they don't need tricorders.
No. No. It's not like there's anything to hide. They have pretty much everything out, right out in the open. Almost.
You certainly don't need a tricorder to figure out whether or not someone's carrying anything in their back pocket or anything. These guys are fairly scantily clad.
Right. Okay.
Now, do you think that the actual the clothing and the presentation, certainly at the front end of the episode, harms it? It does because it does kind of change gear, right? At around the halfway point, and we're having a lot of fun at these guys, making love and being all silly, and I do think this is something that realistically didn't need to be there. I'm not too sure why it was presented in this way.
The way they were dressed, or
yeah, indeed.
Well, I don't know. I thought the dress was obviously it had to be provocative. It had to get their attention to see more about what's going on. It was obviously for the viewer to see some skin, and at some point, some of the clothing, both men and women, seem pretty revealing.
No, it absolutely does. To be honest, it seemed as if it was a planet of 1960s swingers or something like that.
Right. That's kind of what I was thinking, something similar to that. But they certainly are fit.
Mm-hmm. They are fit indeed.
They are fit indeed. Did you notice Troy's little viciousness?
Not particularly. She was relatively cold, right, and standoffish.
Sort of, yes, because when Riker says they certainly are fit, Troy says, yeah, they certainly are. You can kind of tell, she was calling. She's basically referring to Riker as like the man slut that we all know he is. Mm-hmm. Slowly, slowly, I must welcome this lovely one. to which, yeah. Now she immediately changes her attitude when we get the slowly. Slowly, I must welcome this lovely one.
Now, was there anyone doing any work down on this planet?
Didn't see it.
Were they taken to the council or something as well? Did I mishear that?
Yeah, the council chambers.
So the council chambers was where everyone was, semi-naked, engaged in fornication and giving each other back rubs.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And like I said, there was a couple that was actually laying on one of the benches and almost pretty much humping each other.
Well, maybe it's a political issue. Maybe that is what goes on in council chambers.
I don't know. Okay. But, you are a young one, she says to Wesley. I do not know your customs regarding love. Just, he says, whatever you do. Good try.
Well, I mean, at that point, he should have said, well, it's basically, all come, I need at least three at one time. Please make them ready for me.
And give me about 1 minute each, and you'll see what we normally do. So, yeah, I don't know the idea of bringing Wesley down there as a place for young people to relax. I don't know if there's going to be a lot of relaxing. I got a feeling, no offense to everyone, but I got a feeling that planet has a lot of DNA spillage. And that's all I'm going to say. go ahead.
Oh, no. I'm just, my next notes are now back on the Enterprise, where it's, less provocative, I suppose. Mm-hmm. They're beginning to see the spaceship or the space station out there. And there's a bit that I found amusing when LaForge, he states, it's a shadowy something. And then Data then says, exactly. So how's that exactly? He says he's really vague in how he describes it. It's a thingy-majig. Yes, exactly my words. I think even Picard starts getting annoyed how people are being very vague and
it's always a something or whatever. Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. So they figured out it's a shadow something, but we still see nothing. So what does Data do? Without orders or without asking, he hails whatever's off the starboard bow, and boom, that kind of makes him appear. But what triggered a red alert? I mean, do you think somebody got overzealous because they see something appearing?
It's probably the security chief. He's got the big red button and pressed it.
You mean Joe Carey?
Yes.
Yeah. And there's a speculation that that actually may be Joe Carey before he ever made it to the Enterprise when he switched to engineering. So, okay, where was I? Let's see.
They get what the... It's... I mean, I don't know if it's interesting or not, but they send Geordi down, right, to have a, quote-unquote, a real look. And although I think that's an interesting idea because he does have different vision to, you know, to normal humans, he surely can't be better than the sensors, right?
You wouldn't think.
And using the guy that happens to have slightly better vision than you to go down and take a better look, it seems a bit, you know, it's almost as if that's the only thing he's good for. So I don't know how I would feel about it. I mean, maybe once or twice it's okay, but after the 700th time, hey, Geordi, go down and have a proper look. I said, can't you just use the sensors?
Really?
You know, my sensors are on the visor, that passive. You've got all these active sensors, and you should be able to see 50 times more than Geordi.
So what happens at 3 o'clock in the morning when Geordi's asleep? Do they wake him up and say, Geordi, we need you in the observation lounge to take a look at what's off the starboard bow? Yes, sir.
Maybe this is the only reason why he got posted to the flagship. They can, you know, they can use him as an auxiliary sensor array when you know, when main power is down.
Right. Well, they do use his visor at one point to hook it up to a tricorder. So if he means he's no longer necessary. Just leave the visor.
If you're a hard or a Trekkie like me, you have a problem.
Leave the visor.
Whether or not you think you have a problem,
somebody walking back to his quarters
in Star Trek to stay away from your wife, you're spending a lot of time watching Star Trek, or even listening to others talk about Star Trek. But while your mind is engaged in Trek, who's spending time with your pets? Recent studies from the University of Rotterdam-Wingenberg indicate that pets who have Trekkies for owners have the highest depression rates among animals. If you've stopped petting your four-legged companion because of Star Trek, then there's a place that can help. The Federation Pet Depression Center. If Spot's trying to jump into a bathtub with the toaster, then bring him to the Federation Pet Depression Center, otherwise known as Place of Optimism for Pets, or POOP for short. Our pet counselors will help rid your pet of its crippling depression. The Federation Pet Depression Center will help your beloved pet one day at a time. In human years, that is. Contact the Federation Pet Depression Center by subspace today, and we'll beam a counselor to your pet's doghouse, kitty cave, hamster cage, fishbowl, or wherever your pet calls home. Don't wait. Depression will make your dog howl at the moon, or star, or quasar, cosmic string, and so on.
Call us at 7000.
That's not a full number.
64.
What?
4200.
Wait a minute.
47.
That's not real.
47. 47.
Haha, 47, I get it.
6274, Mark.
Huh?
994. 28. 16, 32.
Wait, but...
49.
Hold on a second.
782.
You're making this up. This isn't
5,
a real number.
7.
I give up.
08.
Don't delay. Call today.
Okay, so the ship sends a ball of light towards the Enterprise until it gets to the bridge and gives its demands. One, the first one was state the purpose. That's vague, you know, state the purpose of what you have done.
Yeah, no, it's weird, right? And also, by this point, I mean, right at the beginning of the show, they weren't able to communicate. They didn't know each other's languages, but by the time the little crystal ball gets sent over, he can ask, state the purpose, and the whole ship shakes. I don't know if the ship is shaking because he's shouting loudly or something, but
maybe.
You know, it didn't quite feel right there.
Well, it's a good thing Data was there because obviously it hooks up to one of Data's USB ports and has a, you know, a little bit of a powwow with him. See a Data on the floor with the ball on his head.
And I think everyone was remarkably calm about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, Data's now just got a ball on his head for the next 20, 25 minutes or so. Oh, well.
Right. Well, wait till we get to the end of, what is it, season 2, with Riker's flashback. I don't know. I might pretend to be sick that day, and you have to do it on your own. That's talk about laying in bed doing nothing. Ouch, that episode actually hurts. Okay, so I'm sorry. Back on the planet, the children show off to each other and ask Wesley to teach her how to play ball, running off to the gardens, but nothing good can come from that. Oh, okay. So after they leave, you think that they found out everything about their laws and customs. Why wouldn't they list punishment?
This is a plot contrivance, right? I don't think there's any other way of this being realistic. So they need it to be this way. And I don't know if you noticed, but I think it's slightly the wrong way around in how the scenes were cut, that Worf and Yar find out about the punishment of death, even if you do something very, very minor. And you've already got the train in motion that you need to find Wesley. And this is before Wesley's done anything. And I think the audience is way ahead of Wesley now. Everyone knows that there's going to be this threat, and you're thinking, look, Wesley, don't do something stupid. Don't do something stupid. Don't do something stupid. You've done something stupid. And you're kind of like ahead of the curve here. And that maybe it's because, you need a bit more. You need to feel that the activity taking place is more of a kind of like a life and death situation than simply missing a ball as it gets thrown into a field.
Right.
But I kind of feel at this point it's been flagged up so much what's going to happen and how it's going to happen that it's no surprise when Wesley falls into the flower beds, and it happens to be the day that you've got the zone people checking this area, and he happens to have jumped over the white line and Decker and Brian, they're going to kill him there and there on the spot. I think that all of this is, the audience is way ahead of the actual action.
And of course, we know they're not going to be able to do it. But, okay, this is where, I don't know if anybody knows this, but do you remember before we ever recorded our first show, one of the topics, things you wanted to know about, were we going to get together and discuss what we have or just kind of come on and do it? And this is where they're going to realize that we do just come on and just go at it. Because, okay, we need to talk about this punishment, death, for everything. There's a couple problems with this. What do you think about the idea of stepping on the grass when the sign says not to, that you're going to be put to death for it?
Well, as this episode teaches us, and I think it's right at the end, as Picard is summing things up, I think it's very unfair and unjust to have kind of such strict rules around, frankly, around any law. So as soon as you make it so that whatever you do, you die.
Yeah.
I don't think that leads to a more orderly society.
Right.
Frankly, if it did, for example, if you did happen to fall over onto the grass, then what's stopping you, whilst waiting to be killed, to go around and murder as many people as you can in a fit of rage or something like that? I don't see that. Once you've been told that, hey, you've got basically 5 seconds left before we kill you, I would imagine that the people given out the punishment would have the shortest life expectancy of anyone on the planet, because I don't think, because at that point no one has anything to lose.
That's it. Right. We haven't put any, I don't think we've put any sound clips in here, so I want to put one in at this point where Tasha and Worf actually learn about the punishment, and then we'll get on.
Are you telling me that there's no crime here whatsoever? No one breaks any laws?
Once they did. Long, long ago, there was much disorder. But not now.
But I've seen no sign of police. Those who enforce laws? Oh, we have very few. They are called mediators, and they are needed only in one place each day.
The punishment zone, an area that's selected for a period of time.
It's a completely random selection?
No one but our mediators know what place or for how long. We're very proud of the wisdom of our ancestors. No person ever knows where or when a zone will be.
And so no one risks death.
Death?
By breaking any law. Wait, explain this.
Only one punishment for any crime.
Anyone who commits any crime in the punishment zone dies?
The law is the law. Our peace is built on that.
Even a small thing? Such as ignoring the rule, keep off the grass? Well, then no one breaks that rule. Who wants to risk execution? And there's always a white wall or fence to remind anyone of a forbidden area like that. And just who tells visitors about these rules?
We'd better find Wesley.
Okay, so now, okay, a couple questions I have about this. Obviously, they're going to kill Wesley. That means they execute children.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're saying that, I mean, that makes no sense. Okay, here's my questions. A couple things. If a baby crawls into the punishment zone, they're going to kill the baby? Ignorance is no excuse for the law. You can't get anything more ignorant than a child. Or what about a mentally challenged person? Is there no insanity defense? No appeal process? I guess these are the questions they don't answer, but, you know, this is crazy. Well, on the one hand, for murder, homicides, I'd like to see him kill him instantly. That'd be good for me. But the idea that a child, wow, how do you teach a 6-year-old, don't touch that or you'll be put to death?
Well, you better rely on an extremely high birth rate so that like 9 out of 10 children don't make it age 12 or so. Because you simply wouldn't be able to. You'd have to have, well, you know, you'd have to have such an abundance of children that you wouldn't actually mind losing most of them to these ludicrous rules.
What if a parent decides that they don't like their child anymore and they put up a punishment zone? You know, don't mess your room up. This is a punishment zone. First scarf that hits the floor, you kill the child? I mean, okay, here's another thing. What about outside the punishment zone? Does that mean crime is open game? They say you always know the location because they put up the white wall or fence. What if there's no white wall or fence? Are you free to just shank anybody you want?
I did in the episode itself. It's strange that the punishment zone changes throughout the day.
Yeah.
And it was Wesley obviously committed the crime by falling onto the flowers, but then when the guys come to. Is it the mediators?
Yes.
I can't quite remember what they were.
Yes, mediators.
When they come along to execute him and they get into a fight with Riker, the reason why Riker's not put to death is because the punishment zone's now moved on. And they've, at that point, they basically, the mediator tells Riker that whatever crime he now commits, it's fair game because the punishment zone's elsewhere. So at that point, you can start beating him to death. There and then, it's a very weird way of dealing with things, but I think that realistically these nuanced arguments are probably beyond what they had in mind when they initially wrote the script.
But this is why I like this episode, because of what we're able to discuss here. I mean, I've got more on this. Wesley disturbs the new plants, so the mediators arrive within seconds. Where did they come from? I mean, do they beam in a certain area and then run in? Are they lurking in the shadows? Is it like a police officer? What do you call them, bobbies?
No, they appear to be coming from like over the hill. They appear to be making their way after having heard the disturbance. So it's strange that you probably would have seen them, right? Someone must have seen these guys lurking around.
Right. Who's that man in the shadows? I mean, who's that guy on the other lurking in the bushes waiting for somebody to violate the punishment zone? And they said no one has ever committed crime for how many years? So obviously these people aren't lurking around waiting for crimes because they happen all the time and someone gets away with it. So obviously it had to catch them completely off, by surprise. But they seem to be right there, Johnny, on the spot. Okay, speak the truth. We are mediators. Okay, well, what if everyone just shut their mouth and told them to kiss their ass? You know, what evidence do they have? Or if they can't determine who the transgressor is, do they all die? I mean, what if they just plead the fifth? Do you know what I mean by that?
I do, but they wouldn't. I mean, I think that the system of justice that they have, or certainly the system of punishment that they have, kind of relies on, even by the way, you don't have the entire world under the punishment zone at any one time, it kind of relies on kind of self-enforcement of the law. So it doesn't surprise me that people wouldn't stand up, lie to the police officers.
Really?
Or whatever. I think that something like this would require the people living there to be very, very fearful of what would happen in these extreme eventualities. Now, as soon as you start throwing in things like lying to the police and so on, no doubt that is a crime. No doubt, you know, you'd be put to death if anything came, if anything later showed that you were guilty of that. Huh. So it doesn't surprise me that people are capitulating so quickly to this kind of thing.
So you're basically saying the citizens of this world walk into the disintegration booth on their own.
I think that there have been cultures and societies in the past that would gladly accept that as part of the trade-off to have a like a crime-free or a peaceful planet.
So if you get a psychotic, he kills somebody, and I don't know what you're talking about, prove it in a court of law. There is no court of law. They've got their little syringes right there on their hip. It's a good thing when they're running that they don't fall and accidentally poke themselves.
Yes, absolutely.
But there's witnesses, an admission of guilt, and so they're ready to give the poison. Okay, what if Wesley said, I didn't do it, she did it? And she says, I didn't do it, he did it. I suppose now we have a he said, she said, and then we have the other two witnesses that, no, he did it. That's my girl. She didn't do it, he did it. Do you think that would be enough? Circumstantial evidence? No reasonable doubt in this culture? Oh, man, we could go on forever about this punishment.
No, absolutely. Although, you know, as Wesley mentions in this episode, Starfleet don't lie.
Yes.
But the situation that you have would, I mean, the situation you describe, I do think it goes against the kind of society that they're trying to put across, which is that everyone you know, almost to the fault is happy to live within the rules of, you know, complete honesty and horrendous crimes for, you know, rather minor transgressions, because what they gain out of it is, you know, security and, you know, freedom from crime. And, you know, as you mentioned in terms of the disintegration chamber, obviously you're quoting back to A Taste of Armageddon from the original series. I think that kind of society is closer than many people would imagine. I do think so. Now, I would actually probably argue that this might be a US-Europe divide here, by the way, because, you know, the US in particular is founded with not necessarily hostility towards the government, but certainly skepticism towards the government and trying to keep the government always in check from the people. You know, coming out of Europe, we're a bunch of people that have grown from various monarchies where, you know, a good king looked after these guys, a good king looked after these guys, and you kind of placed your faith in them. I think that, you know, it doesn't surprise me that people would be willing to accept this kind of, both the society that is shown injustice and also the society that's in A Taste of Armageddon. This stuff actually wouldn't surprise me.
Really? I'd be stunned. I mean, you know, here we talk about a police state, and there's plethora of YouTube videos of people who drive around just to piss off the Border Patrol people. So you won't have fun with that. No, I don't have to give you my ID. No, I don't have to tell you if I'm a citizen. There are people that make a sport here in the United States of pissing off the police. And they do it just to see what they're going to do about it. And so it's interesting over there. I mean, you guys don't, I don't think you, do you have something that comes close to our Fifth Amendment to self-incrimination?
I do not know. I've not been put in that position.
So I don't know.
But, even if you think about in terms of the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights, in the U.K. at least, we don't have a Bill of Rights. We don't have a there's no written constitution. It is the law is whatever the law happens to be at any given time, and there's a huge amount of freedom given to the government, which is is elected, of course, but there's a huge amount of freedom given to them in order to manage whatever they have to manage. I know in the U.S. in particular, you can start getting laws that are unconstitutional, laws that go against the various amendments that have been put in place. And it, from an outsider's point of view, it always sounds like it's much harder for the government in your neck of the woods to actually do stuff, to actually make the big bold moves one way or the other. I think in the UK, it's we don't have anywhere something written down that states there's we have the right to right not to incriminate ourselves. As far as I'm aware, at least.
Fascinating. Really?
And remember, of course, I mean, we're talking about a continent that 60 years ago was, descended into war with, with a vast proportion of the continent under, fascist control. Roll back a generation before that, and everyone was at war. Roll back a generation before that, and everyone was still at war. Wow. It's a kind of different... America is still a young country. Europe is a continent that's been at war with various factions, realistically, since the beginning of time.
Mm. Wow.
Roll back to the Roman Empire, with the potential that maybe in the Middle Ages things were a little bit better because basically there wasn't any government of any sort. But we don't have, we don't have a formalized doctrine of governance that U.S. have.
Really?
Hey, this has been a tangent.
No, that's fine. I think I like learning this stuff, so it's good for me. Basically, I mean, if they put Wesley on trial and he gets a not guilty, I guess in over here, once you can get a suspect that's admitted to murder, get a jury trial, be found not guilty, and it's done. Whereas there was a case of Amanda somebody or another, I can't think of her last name here, who lived here, went to Italy, was suspected in the murder of somebody over there, and they keep bringing her back to try her, even when she's been found not guilty. So, it's amazing here in America, once you get found not guilty, you're done, you walk out of the courthouse. Whereas in other countries, you get found not guilty, well, that just means we start this over again until you are found guilty. I mean,
you're speaking about double jeopardy, though,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it is true. In the UK, you don't have double jeopardy protection.
Amazing.
You can't continue to be brought in front of a judge and have the court proceedings. There's obviously a certain amount of evidence threshold that has to be crossed. In the UK, at least, that would be determined by the public prosecution guys. But then, they're fundamentally not necessarily independent. I mean, they're supposed to be independent, but they're fundamentally given their power through the state. But you certainly don't get protection. If you get tried and new evidence comes up, then you get tried again. And in certain circumstances, even if not enough evidence comes up to your liking, at least, you can be tried again.
That's silly. Wow. Where does it finally end? What about the appeal process? Let's say you are found guilty. Can you appeal? What's your appeal process? That'd be interesting things to learn for another day, I guess. Okay, so we got a little bit more here. All right, let's get off the punishment. Leotor suggests that Picard simply take Wesley and leave, since they're so advanced and the Edo are such a backward little world, but Picard mentions a prime directive. So we've already discussed if it was such a big thing about the prime directive, why are they even there?
Yeah, I mean, the Prime Directive came up on Code of Honor as well, right?
Yes.
And they keep mentioning Prime Directive. So I actually looked up the Prime Directive, so I knew what I was. They're not going to, you know, make a fool of myself. And although it is primarily about not, like, interfering in the natural evolution of certain societies, it would also be quoted and used when you're just, you know, not getting involved in internal affairs. So things like, you know, when there was the Klingon Civil War, the Prime Directive was in place, not because the Klingons didn't know about the Federation, but it's just that you don't take sides. So I suspect in this case, these guys know about the Federation, so you're not coming in, you're not taking, you know, there's obviously a judicial process that, even if it's a flaky one, that's in place, and you're not going to come and interfere in that, like, internal affair of the planet. Having said that, to me, it doesn't work. Considering that they've known about the people for like 2 days, and that they came down, and no one explained to anyone that, you know, you're in danger of death if you happen to walk on the grass. It seems very harsh.
Yeah. You would think that they should tell people that, but when they visit...
I like the way that the aliens... is it the Edo? It's the Edo, right?
Yeah.
They're sitting there, and Picard's doing his spiel about how now there's no death penalty, and people once had the death penalty. And then the dude kind of sits and thinks... I think he says, oh, so we're not as advanced as they are.
Right.
I mean, as if the spaceship and the warp drive and the transporter didn't prove that already. I think, of course, these guys aren't as advanced as the Federation.
So
that was something that tickled me.
You know, another thing I didn't notice? Houses. I haven't noticed any houses. Everybody seemed to be out in the open. So, now... those two that were laying on the bench, pretty much almost humping each other. Well, let's say that moment comes. Were they just going to stay right there?
Yeah, well, probably. I would imagine so. because it's no time to, no time to having to walk back home, right?
No.
Who wants to get up and then spend the next 30 minutes walking home?
Well, they don't walk home. They run home. So it'll be about 10 minutes.
Oh, they do. Perhaps.
Yeah.
Or perhaps they do then.
Yeah, maybe they do. Are there times that they have the punishment zone, so they now have the sex zone, from this area, no children allowed? Or do those kids, when they're not playing ball, do they go back to the council chambers and watch the adults and wait for their turn? I don't know. It's really weird. There's a lot of unanswered questions here. So Picard wants to talk to Beverly about Wesley and asked to take an Edo to look at God. What was the point of that?
Actually, there's no point of this at all, because Picard is told Data has woken up, or he's now ready to talk, and he has a whole load of stuff to tell you.
Oh, yeah.
And he says, well, actually, first I'm going to take this Edo up, and she'll look at God, and then God will get angry, and then she'll be beamed down, and... then I'll go and talk to Data, and basically nothing comes out of the Edo going up onto the Enterprise. Other than my observation, which is, didn't anyone tell her that she perhaps should get dressed before she goes up to the Enterprise?
Could be cold up there.
It could be cold.
Could be cold. It certainly was. It looked a little cold. But here's another thing, and I've talked about this on the Lou Trick Show. I've never talked about it on this one until right now. God starts coming towards the ship, and so Picard tosses his comm badge on her. What was her name?
Revan.
Revan.
Revan, yeah.
Okay, well, anyway, Picard throws his badge on her and says, transporter room, one to beam out. Well, unless the transporter is always monitoring, watching the video, and sees what Picard does, how come they never come back with which one?
Absolutely, and... there are a number of cases where there's like a group of eight, and they say five to beam up.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, well, that's like, that's five out of these eight people. We could be here all day, beaming up the various combinations and not getting the right guys. They always seem to know who gets beamed up and they always seem to know, you know, exactly. They know exactly correctly who gets beamed up, whether they have comm badges or not. I mean, perhaps in fairness here, Picard's asking, you know, one's beam up, and his own comm badge is on the is on the scantily clad Edo. But even then, I think an order like a, you know, please beam the Edo down to the planet.
Or my comm badge, lock up, like, who was it? Oh, Sisko. You know, he puts his comm badge, or he, no, it was a tricorder, lock onto this tricorder and beam it out into space for the tribble thing. But, I mean, you got to tell him who's going to beam up and down. And then he was impatient, you know, transporter room, lock on, urgent, transporter room, now! Even as she was dematerializing, he's still yelling at the transporter chief to beam her down now!
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost as if they put the effect in post-production.
Yes.
and did you notice that, something that I noticed as they then, as Beverly and then Picard wandered off? It's not quite an admission, but it did make me smile. Beverly turns to Picard and states, you know, if he were your son, and then Picard says, but I am. And it was nearly... It was as close as I think we're going to get to an admission by Picard that he's Wesley's dad.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, that is one thing Brian did. There's a whole thing about Wesley Picard. And I'm sure I've got it here somewhere. If not, I will pull it up. But this, it might be an interesting idea to put it in here about Wesley Picard and why. It was about the Traveler and Jack Crusher and... I hope everybody doesn't mind, but I'm going to find that and put that in right here, right now, about Wesley Picard.
Have you ever wondered if Wesley Crusher is really Jean-Luc Picard's son? Our story begins with the Traveler, whom, you may have noticed, looks like a cross between Picard and Crusher, but that's a different chicken or the egg story. The Traveler is an alien man of mystery. He is capable of bending the dimensions of time and space with his mind. He also loves Mozart. The Traveler is also responsible for Wesley Crusher. In fact, the Traveler had a role in making Captain Jean-Luc Picard the biological father of Wesley Crusher. In the late 18th century, from Tau Alpha C, the Traveler cocked his ear towards Earth and overheard the music of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, and was so enraptured by the music that he abducted the composer and requested the complete works of Mozart. Mozart, unaccustomed to alien abductions, did not survive the teleportation back to Tau Alpha C. The Traveler, for all his abilities, could not wake the dead, so he returned Mozart to Earth and was made to appear to have died from a fever. Stricken with guilt and grief, the Traveler sought to atone for his transgression. He would return to Earth time and again in search of the next Mozart. His search finally ended over 500 years later when he heard a teenaged Jean-Luc Picard at a Starfleet Academy piano concert. Ensign Picard, with the heart of a poet and the soul of an explorer, wowed his audience with his renditions of Mozart's first 40 symphonies. The Traveler made it his primary duty to nurture this young genius and perpetuate his lineage. Using his cosmic shape-shifting abilities, the Traveler guided Picard in the forms of his mentors Richard Galen, Donald Varley, and Boothby. The Traveler has also appeared before Picard in the forms of girlfriends Penny Muroc, Agnes Fern, better known as AF, and Janice Mannheim. Picard's attitude towards romance took a radical 180-degree turn when he picked a fight with a gang of Nausicaans while trying to win the affections of Marta Botanides away from his Academy classmate and rival Corton Zweller. Picard was mortally wounded by a knife to the heart. Picard survived his attack when he was fitted with an artificial heart, and he never wanted anything to do with women again. Jean-Luc, at that time in his life, wasn't worried about carrying on the family name. He was satisfied his brother Robert, a regular Don Juan, would be cranking out sons by the dozen. Alarmed by the near loss of his new pupil, the Traveler concocted a desperate plan to ensure the continuance of his Mozart protégé. During Picard's junior officer years, when he became best friends of Walker Keel and Jack Crusher, the Traveler disguised himself as Beverly Howard, where he orchestrated an excuse to examine Picard at her office at Starfleet Medical on Starbase 515. Then the traveler, as Dr. Howard, slips Picard a hypospray Mickey and proceeds to seduce him. The traveler then fills a hypospray with DNA gathered from Picard and, still disguised as Jack's fiancée, injects Jack Crusher with Picard's DNA, claiming it to be an inoculation for the Nausicaan flu. Unbeknownst to Jack Crusher, Picard's DNA began to overwrite Crusher's reproductive system, and 9 months later, Operation Picard Beyond is a success. Jack and Beverly Crusher's first son is born, Wesley Robert Crusher. The traveler had hoped Jack would continue to sire more children to ensure more Mozarts, but alas, Jack didn't have those urges anymore after Wesley, and so he and Picard went off on deep space explorations aboard the USS Stargazer where, 5 years later, Jack dies on an away mission. Well, this upset the traveler to no end. Feeling his work will never be done, the traveler looks after Wesley, who may well be the last of the Picards. He takes the job as the assistant of engineering crackpot Kaczynski, where he immediately recognized Wesley when the kid started taking him to school on warp field mathematics. With the traveler so mesmerized over Picard and his secret son, he lost focus on his work and almost dies when he hurtled the USS Enterprise-D where no one has gone before. The traveler, having given up the hope that Picard will ever make a family of his own, begs Picard to encourage Wesley to be all that he can be, although he doesn't explain the real reason for such a mighty plea. Picard complies, and Wesley is made to feel special. Wesley served aboard the Enterprise, first as an acting ensign, and later as a full ensign. Then he's accepted at Starfleet Academy. The traveler would occasionally disguise himself as Academy groundskeeper Boothby to keep an eye on Wesley. But after the incident of the Nova Squadron cover-up that involved the death of a classmate, the traveler then realized he was going to have to involve himself in determining Wesley's fate. Upon entering adulthood, Wesley visits the village people of Dorvon 5, where the traveler posed as a villager and Wesley's deceased father to coax Wesley to drop out of the academy and seek a new path. Then the traveler reveals himself after Wesley dislocates himself from his plane of existence. They go off together for exploration and mentoring. Upon learning of the deaths of Captain Picard's brother and nephew, the traveler becomes distressed over the fact that now Wesley really is the last of the Picards. Soon Wesley became bored and rebellious, and the traveler would have to return Wesley to the human race. His final gift to Wesley was his cosmic powers. This final act causes the traveler to fade into oblivion, possibly forever. Wesley, having finally discovered his special purpose, gets invited to the wedding of the Rikers, where he begins gaping uncontrollably at Deanna Troi. Wesley, now a lieutenant in junior grade, serves with Captain William Thomas Riker aboard the USS Titan. Now in full control of his powers and abilities, Wesley shapeshifts himself to appear to Riker as Deanna. Bow chicka wow wow. Then, as the Titan's chief medical officer. And Riker gets inoculated with Crusher Picard DNA. And the cycle is repeated, and would be repeated again and again, for generation after generation. That is, until Ambassador Spock and Romulan mining Captain Nero clashed and screwed up everything. Now back in the 23rd century, the traveler finds himself existing once again and remembering everything that led up to this altered timeline. He began cursing across the cosmos, "Not again!"
Here's another thing. On the planet, Troi says, as Picard is talking to Crusher about Data, you know, he's rebooted and he's back up again. Troi says, "Wesley." And he shuts his comm badge off and says, "I want to talk to her personally about her son." So what happens when they get back on the ship? She says, "I saw the away team report about my son. So I'm wondering who leaked that information."
Absolutely. I mean, this is a, I'm going to get routed. What? Did we put the press release out already?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to get hell for this.
Maybe it was that eavesdropping transporter that knows everything and knows who to beam up that he saw it. And he, little water cooler gossip. All right. So Data reports on his experiences, but makes comments that actually irk Dr. Crusher, and makes Picard tell him not to babble. You know, it's interesting. The whole thing, what's he say about motherhood as compared to others, and, oh, shut up, and runs out of the room.
Yeah, I found it. I mean, at this point, you can see what Data's in the story for. He's in the story to basically info dump everything that needs to be put across to Picard in order for him to make the call in 5 minutes' time as they're down on the planet. And I do think it's it is just a straight up info dump.
Yeah,
the bad guys or the adversaries in the episode manage to possess Data. They dump a whole load of information. They need him to tell the captain. He then sits and he tells the captain. And frankly, as I said just a little while ago, they didn't need to bring the Edo on board. That added nothing. As soon as Data was up and running, Picard could have beamed up. Data info dumps onto him, and they move on. Mm-hmm. And then I did appreciate the shut up.
Yes,
with Crusher getting upset and then running off. Yeah. I'm still in. By the way, I mean there's a lot of some of the shows that shall remain nameless that I listen to have a lot of hostility towards Dr. Crusher and Gates McFadden in particular. And, I don't know. I can't see it. I'm liking Gates McFadden. I'm liking Crusher here. Even in this particular city scene. In fact, I think what comes immediately after this is I think it's Picard and Crusher spend time talking about whether or not to interfere and whether or not they would be judged by our own standards or not. And I think these are good conversations that take place between Crusher and Picard. And then also, as you go later on, even at this early stage in the season, you can see that there's a decent relationship built in there. Yeah. So I'm a fan.
Yeah, I understand, yeah. Well, I think, it's Data that, they'd be judging us by our own rules. So the last thing I have on this is Picard and Beverly beam down and attempt the jailbreak, but the Edo god stops their getaway, and Picard has to plead for Wesley's release. And thank goodness for Riker, because, when has justice ever been as simple as a rule book? And the Edo god must agree to that, or, I don't know, maybe it's just Riker. He's just trying to get rid of Riker because of his influence on his children.
But yes, so perhaps that's it. Perhaps it's the damage this guy can do if he's left down here too long versus these guys breaking their own rules. Right. Or I'll let them go. I actually did, I did like how this episode ended, because there's no like magic bullet, there's no golden answer at the end that solves everyone's problems. It gets to the point where Picard has to make the call about whether or not he believes that a very strict interpretation of the Prime Directive has to apply here against the unfair situation that Wesley finds himself in. And Picard does have to make that call, and he does, and he chooses that Wesley doesn't deserve to be put to death. And whatever the mild consequences are to society, they have to abide by that. And he doesn't necessarily know whether or not he's going to lose his command due to this decision. So I do like that they have to make, Picard has to make that decision. It's not as if everything gets cleaned up and by some miracle it no longer applies or anything. He does have to make that decision by himself. The bit where they kind of get called back or prevent him from beaming out, I think is also, I also quite like, because it allows people to have a little bit of a debate about, the moral of the week. I do think that they, for an episode that I think at the beginning starts off relatively fluffy and semi naked ladies running around and whatnot, it then people just start throwing around terms that just ignorance of the law can't be an excuse, and things that come out of that discussion, and then Picard, I think the big one is not Riker's thing about when has law just been a rule book, but when Picard starts speaking about there can't really be justice when laws are considered as absolutes. I think there's a lot of truth in that. And when you raised issues about, you know, babies or mentally ill people and so on, you know, that is clearly applicable. So I think that it ends on a relative high in my note. Mm-hmm. And I do like that what, in my opinion, starts out very bad, at least can turn into a bit of a moral debate on the justice system. But hey, that's Star Trek, right?
Right. Okay. Well, then do you have anything else to add on this?
No, I don't think so.
All right. Well, then it's now time to give our final ratings for this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. I'm going to give this one a 4. I think it deserves a 4. I think the moral story is what I'm going off of a 4, and the fact that, you know, we had a good discussion about the punishment of death for everything. Although I don't really think it's fitting for everything. I think it could be fitting for a lot of things. But it does give a good moral story. We almost got rid of Wesley. He almost died. But he didn't. So that's why it doesn't get a 5. No, I'm kidding. the softcore porn I could both do with and without. There were some pretty beautiful women down there. And I mean, there were some pretty handsome guys down there, too, as well. But the almost sex in the halls thing, I thought was overdone a little too much. Let's see. Running everywhere you go, fine. They certainly are fit, so they can do that. So overall, I think I'm basing my score on the plot line, the story. The Edo God, the download the data thing, I could care less about, but the story of the plot line is what gets me for this one. So yes, it's a 4. James?
Okay. This is weird. I came into this particular episode thinking that this one was horrendous and it was going to be like a 1 out of 5, kind of episode. And I don't know whether it's just because, you know, my famous case of forgiving everything that Next Generation does or not. But when I sat down and watched it, and when you get past the fact that there are naked people running around, and you get past this, well, I think there's a lot of terrible acting going on. But once you get past the first 15 minutes or so, and it manages to present itself as this kind of moral discussion point, which Trek does a lot of, I do think the episode does get lifted. I think that there are things that you can discuss on this episode. I think it's a rather simplistic view, right, of the scenario. So it is certainly a little bit of a, you know, you take a concept and you reduce it almost, you know, ad absurdum, so it's almost, you know, beyond belief as it would ever be able to be implemented this way. But I did enjoy it. I do think that it was a, I think the stuff from this, maybe two-thirds of the episode, or a third of the episode through to the end, was good, and you know, there are debates to be had, and I did enjoy that. I don't think it gets as high up as a 4, unfortunately. To me, this comes in somewhere around the 2 to 3 mark, in my opinion. And despite the fact that I've always said that I don't like doing decimals, so you know, 2.5 and whatnot, I find it very difficult to plug these episodes to a particular whole number. But I think that on balance, it probably just scrapes in to a 3-star episode. And I think that's where I see it. And it was really, you know, completely against what my memory of this episode was. My memory of this episode was, you know, dreadful. And rewatching it did have a lot of, you know, it had a lot of Star Trek-y qualities that, that we've obviously spent the hour discussing, and hopefully, you know, hopefully have led, you know, a couple of 8-year-old kids watching this thing to think a little bit deeper about, you know, the world that they want to live in.
Right. That's fascinating. Okay. Well, is there anything else you want to add to this?
No, I don't think so. I think we're all good.
All right.
Next time on Star Trek: The Next Generation.
So, what's the cause of my headache?
I haven't the slightest idea.
An old enemy is playing tricks with the captain's mind. In a deadly game of revenge.
You murdered my only son.
No, he's forced to relive a terrifying battle.
Look for a silver sphere. Destroy it!
On Star Trek, The Next Generation.
So that's going to bring us to the end of Justice. Join us next week for Season 1, Episode 9, The Battle. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London. And good night, everyone.
I miss you, Android. Take care. Good night.